Psycho-Cybernetics by Maxwell Maltz. An audio summary narrated for the AIIO book library. Maxwell Maltz was not a psychologist. He was a plastic surgeon, and this book grew out of something he noticed in his own operating theatre. He would correct a disfigurement, a scar, a misshapen nose, and in most cases the change in the patient was immediate and total. Within days they carried themselves differently, spoke differently, and behaved as though a weight had been lifted. But in a stubborn minority of cases, nothing changed at all. The surgery was a success, the face in the mirror was objectively different, and the patient continued to feel and act exactly as ugly and as unwanted as before. Some insisted they could see no difference whatsoever. That puzzle is the seed of the whole book. Maltz concluded that he had been operating on the wrong thing. What actually governed how these people lived was not the face itself, but the picture they carried of themselves on the inside. Change the face and leave the picture untouched, and nothing happens. Change the picture, and the person changes whether you operate or not. Psycho-Cybernetics was published in 1960. It has sold in the tens of millions, and it sits underneath an enormous amount of what came afterwards. Almost every visualization exercise, every affirmation practice, every sports psychology routine involving mental rehearsal traces back through this book. If you have heard that it takes 21 days to form a habit, that number came from here, and later in this summary we will look at why it is not quite what people think it is. The word cybernetics comes from the Greek for steersman, the person who holds the tiller of a boat. Maltz borrowed it deliberately from the engineering of his day, and his central claim is a mechanical one. The human brain and nervous system, he argues, operate as a goal-striving servo mechanism. Give a torpedo a target, and it does not travel in a straight line. It moves, samples its error, corrects, overshoots, corrects again, and zigzags its way to the target through a continuous process of negative feedback. Maltz says the human mind works the same way. It is not a machine that succeeds by never making mistakes. It is a machine that succeeds by making mistakes and correcting them, provided it has been given a clear target. That leads to two conclusions he builds the entire book on. First, the mechanism is impersonal. It does not care what you aim it at. Aimed at a goal you genuinely want, it becomes what he calls the automatic success mechanism, quietly solving problems, surfacing ideas, and steering you toward the target. Aimed at avoiding failure, at not being humiliated, at not being found out, it works equally hard and delivers exactly that. Second, and more importantly, the target is set by your self-image. Your self-image is the conception you hold of what sort of person you are, built up from every experience and interpretation you have accumulated, particularly in childhood. Maltz insists it is not a philosophy. To the person holding it, it is not opinion at all. It is simply the truth about themselves, and it is almost never questioned. And here is the sentence the book turns on. You will never outperform your self-image. It sets the boundary of what is possible for you, not because it is accurate, but because you will unconsciously act to keep it consistent. Set a goal outside it, and you will sabotage the goal, or you will reach it and then quietly give the result away, because a person cannot live for long in a way that contradicts who they believe they are. The good news follows directly. The self-image is not a fixed fact. It was learned, which means it can be changed. And you do not need decades of analysis to change it. Chapter 1 lays out the discovery. Maltz gives the case histories, the salesman whose income was pinned to a figure he could not exceed, the patients whose scars were removed with no effect at all, the students labeled stupid who turned out to be nothing of the kind once the label was lifted. In each case, the limiting factor was a belief, not a capacity. He is careful about the word belief. Self-image beliefs are not held with argument or evidence. They are held the way you hold the fact that the floor will support you. That is why arguing with someone's low opinion of themselves does not move it, and why compliments bounce off. The belief is not being maintained by reasons, so reasons will not shift it. Chapter 2 turns to the machinery. Maltz argues that every living thing has a built-in guidance system, and that in animals it exists only to keep them fed and alive. In humans, it does something more, because human beings can imagine goals that do not yet exist and hand them to the mechanism. He sets out how to use it. You must supply a clearly defined target, because the machine cannot steer toward a vague wish. You must trust it to work, which means acting without a complete plan and letting course correction happen on the way. You must not jam it by trying to consciously control every move, which is the mechanical version of the advice not to try too hard. And you must accept that error and correction are how it functions, not evidence that it is broken. That last point matters more than it sounds. A great deal of human misery, in Maltz's account, comes from treating a negative result as a verdict on the self rather than as a steering correction, which is all the mechanism ever intended it to be. This is the most influential chapter in the book and the one everything else depends on. Maltz argues that the nervous system does not draw a sharp line between an experience that actually happened and one that has been imagined vividly and in detail. What it stores and what it steers by is the imagined picture. If that is true, then you can supply the mechanism with experience it has never actually had, and it will treat that experience as real data about who you are and what you can do. The practical exercise he gives has a name: the theater of the mind. You sit somewhere quiet for roughly 30 minutes a day, close your eyes, and construct a scene in as much sensory detail as you can manage. Not a wish, and not a general feeling of confidence, but a specific scene, with the room, the light, the sounds, the faces, and above all yourself inside it. Acting the way you want to act, and feeling the way you would feel. You watch yourself handle it well. Maltz is insistent about the detail, because vagueness is what makes the practice fail. A blurred picture is weak data. He is equally insistent on the daily repetition, because the mechanism is being retrained by accumulation, not by one dramatic session. He supports this with the experimental work available to him. Most famously, a study of basketball free throw shooting, in which a group that practiced only mentally improved almost as much as a group that practiced physically, while a group that did nothing did not improve at all. Modern sports science has broadly supported the underlying effect, and we will come back to that in the critique. The reframe he offers is the useful part. You are already doing this. Everyone rehearses mentally all day long. The person who lies awake replaying a humiliation or playing forward a meeting that has not happened yet and watching themselves fumble it is running the theater of the mind with the wrong film. Maltz is not asking you to acquire a new capacity. He is asking you to take control of one you are already using against yourself. Maltz uses hypnosis as an analogy, and he uses it precisely. A hypnotized subject told they cannot lift a pencil, genuinely cannot lift it. Their strength has not changed. Their belief about their strength has, and the body obeys the belief. Maltz's claim is that most people are walking around under exactly this kind of suggestion, with no hypnotist involved. They were told something, or concluded something, or absorbed something from an offhand remark decades ago, and they have been quietly obeying it ever since. The point of the chapter is that the limitation is real in its effects, while being entirely false in its foundation. The man who believes he cannot speak in public will genuinely dry up on stage. His fear is not imaginary, but the underlying belief was never true, and never tested. The way out, Maltz says, is not willpower. Effort of will directed against a belief usually strengthens it, because straining to not be nervous keeps attention fixed on the nervousness. He draws on what he calls the law of reversed effort, the observation that when imagination and will are in conflict, imagination reliably wins. Trying harder to cross a plank you are imagining yourself falling off will not help you cross it. So the instruction is to go after the picture rather than the effort. Change what you are imagining, and the behavior follows without a fight. Having said that reason alone cannot shift a self-image, Maltz now gives reason a specific and limited job, and the distinction is worth getting right. Conscious rational thought cannot install a new self-image by argument. What it can do is act as the gatekeeper that decides what the mechanism is fed. Your reasoning mind chooses the goal, judges the evidence, and rejects the false conclusion before it is handed down to the automatic machinery. It is the steersman setting the course, not the engine driving the boat. He offers a plain test for the beliefs you are carrying. Ask whether there is any rational reason to believe this thing at all. Ask whether you might be reasoning from a single incident to a general rule about yourself, which is the most common of all self-image errors. And ask whether the conclusion you drew as a child from a childhood event has ever once been re-examined by the adult you are now. Usually it has not. the chapter's most quoted piece of practical advice, concerns responsibility for feeling. Maltz argues that our emotional reactions follow from our beliefs about events rather than the events themselves, which places the leverage inside us rather than in the world. That idea now sounds unremarkable, which is a measure of how thoroughly it has been absorbed. It appeared here more than a decade before cognitive therapy made it mainstream. Maltz devotes a whole chapter to relaxation because in his model, tension is not just uncomfortable, it is mechanically disabling. Excessive conscious effort jams the servo mechanism in exactly the way that gripping the wheel too hard makes you drive worse. His argument is that the automatic mechanism does its best work when the conscious mind gets out of the way. Everyone has experienced this. The name you cannot recall arrives the moment you stop chasing it. The solution appears in the shower rather than at the desk. He teaches physical relaxation first, working through the body deliberately, and then a mental technique he became known for. You build a room in your imagination. You design it in complete detail, the colors, the chair, the window, and what is outside it, the quality of the light, the quiet. You furnish it over many sessions until it is entirely familiar. And then you go there for a few minutes when you need to, and the accumulated detail lets the nervous system recognize it as a place where nothing is required of you. He calls this a decompression chamber. The practical claim is that you can carry a place of stillness with you, and that it becomes more effective the more often you visit it, because familiarity is what makes it work. Maltz takes an unusually blunt position here. Happiness, he says, is not a moral reward that arrives when you deserve it, and it is not primarily produced by circumstances. It is a mental habit, and like any habit, it can be practiced deliberately. His evidence is the ordinary observation that people return to a characteristic level of mood after both good and bad events, and that two people in identical circumstances routinely report entirely different experiences of them. If circumstances were doing the work, that could not happen. The prescription is deliberately small and practical. Decide in advance to hold a cheerful attitude for a fixed period and treat it as a training exercise rather than a claim about how good your life is. Refuse to be drawn into reacting to trivial provocations and notice how much of your mood is spent on things that will not matter in a week. Practice on ordinary days rather than waiting for a crisis, because a habit built only under pressure was never built at all. He also makes the point that most unhappiness is not caused by present events, but by the continuous mental rehearsal of past grievances and future disasters, which is the theater of the mind again, running the wrong film. The remedy is the same remedy. Maltz sets out seven ingredients of what he calls the success-type personality, arranged so their initials spell the word success. Sense of direction, a goal to steer toward, because the mechanism cannot function without a target, and a person without one is not at rest, they are adrift. Understanding, seeing situations as they actually are, rather than through the distortion of your own assumptions, which usually means listening properly and being willing to be wrong. Courage, acting despite uncertainty on the grounds that the mechanism only corrects course once it is moving, so refusing to act is not caution, but paralysis. Charity, a genuine regard for other people, which Maltz treats as practical rather than saintly, because a person who thinks little of others generally thinks little of themselves. Esteem, appreciating the worth of other human beings, and by extension your own, without inflation. Self-confidence, built by deliberately recalling and dwelling on past successes rather than past failures, since both are memories and you get to choose which ones you rehearse. Self-acceptance, accepting yourself as you actually are right now, imperfections included, which he argues is the precondition for change rather than the reward for it. That last one deserves a moment. Maltz is not saying be satisfied, he is saying that you cannot make constructive changes to something you refuse to look at honestly, and that self-contempt is a poor engine because it keeps supplying the mechanism with a picture of a person who fails. The mirror image chapter, and one of the most useful in the book. Maltz lists seven symptoms whose initials spell failure, and his treatment of them is what makes the chapter unusual. Frustration, the feeling produced by a goal that is unreachable or unclear. Aggressiveness, misdirected, meaning energy meant for a goal discharged at the wrong target, usually a person who had nothing to do with it. Insecurity, which he traces to measuring yourself against an impossible standard of completeness rather than against reality. Loneliness, the separation from other people that follows from protecting a fragile self-image. Uncertainty, chronic indecision adopted as a way of never being provably wrong. Resentment, the habit of explaining your position by injustice done to you, which he considers particularly corrosive because it casts you permanently as a victim and hands control to whoever wronged you. And emptiness, the hollowness of reaching goals that were never actually yours. The insight is in the subtitle of the chapter. These are not enemies to be crushed. They are negative feedback. They are the mechanism reporting that you are off course, and they are as useful as the warning lights on a dashboard. The correct response is not to feel ashamed of them, and not to smash the dashboard, but to read them and adjust. So resentment is information that you have handed control away. Frustration is information about the goal, not about you. Emptiness on arrival is information that the target was borrowed from somebody else. Each symptom points at its own correction. Here, Maltz returns to his own profession and pushes the analogy as far as it will go. Physical scar tissue is what forms when a wound has been protected, rather than allowed to heal properly. Emotional scars, he says, form the same way. Someone is hurt, and to avoid ever being hurt like that again, they build a defensive layer. The layer works in the sense that it does prevent the injury being repeated. It also seals the person off from the ordinary contact that makes life worth having, and unlike healthy tissue, it does not feel. The consequence is that the defense outlives the danger by decades. A person is still being guarded against something that stopped happening in 1974, and the cost is being paid daily by people who were never involved. His prescriptions are direct. Forgiveness he treats not as a moral obligation, but as a surgical one. He is emphatic that forgiveness is only complete when the debt is cancelled entirely. Because forgiving while keeping a ledger open is not forgiveness, it is just a quieter form of resentment, and it maintains the scar. He argues for a thicker skin and a softer heart, meaning less reactivity to slights rather than less contact with people. He warns against carrying wounds as identity, because a scar you have built a self around cannot be given up without giving up the self. And he notes that self-inflicted scars, the things you cannot forgive yourself for, follow exactly the same rule and require the same cancellation of the debt. Maltz makes a claim here that is worth stating carefully, because it is easy to misread as flattery. He does not believe that personality is something you construct. He believes it is something already present that has been covered over. What we call a poor personality is, in his account, a normal personality that has been inhibited, hedged and edited by fear of what other people will think. The person is not missing anything. They are holding it in. The mechanism he identifies is self-consciousness in the literal sense, attention turned inward and monitoring the self during the very moment that requires attention outward. The person who is shy in conversation is not failing to think of things to say. They are busy watching themselves, and there is not enough attention left to do both. The way out is not more self-monitoring in the form of technique. It is to give attention to the task and the other person and let the self-conscious observer go unattended. He gives the specific advice to stop rehearsing the impression you are making and to become genuinely interested in what is in front of you. He also, in a passage that has aged well, tells the reader to accept that they will be criticized, that being disliked by some people is a normal cost of being a person at all, and that the attempt to be universally approved of is the thing doing the inhibiting. This chapter is Maltz's practical toolkit for holding a settled mind under pressure, and its central image is architectural. A tranquilizer, he points out, does not remove the noise. It changes your response to the noise. He argues you can build the same buffer deliberately, and he returns to the quiet room from chapter 6 as the foundation of it. The main technique he adds is disturbance proofing by non-response. Most of what agitates us does so because we answer it. The telephone rings and we jump. Maltz suggests deliberately practicing with small things, letting the phone ring twice before moving, and letting an irritation pass unanswered, in order to establish that a stimulus does not have to be obeyed. The gap between the event and your reaction is where all your freedom lives, and it can be widened with practice. He also insists on living in the present as a mental hygiene measure rather than a poetic one. The nervous system can only ever respond to what it is being shown. Show it a past humiliation, and it produces the chemistry of humiliation now. Show it a feared future, and it produces fear now. Most suffering is therefore self-supplied, delivered by a mechanism doing exactly what it was designed to do with the material it was given. Holtz observes that the same word, crisis, covers two entirely different outcomes. Some people are diminished by pressure, and some are enlarged by it, and the difference is not the amount of pressure. His explanation is about where attention goes. Under threat, most people shift from wanting to win to not wanting to lose, and that shift changes the target handed to the mechanism. The mechanism obeys. Being aimed at avoiding disaster produces cautious, tight, defensive behavior, which in most real situations is exactly what causes the disaster. His advice is unusually concrete for a book of this kind. Practice without pressure, so that the skill is already automatic before the stakes arrive, and treat every low-stakes repetition as the real rehearsal. Do not try too hard in the moment, because excessive effort jams the mechanism precisely when you need it running. Keep the goal in front of you, rather than the consequences of failure, and, in his best line on the subject, learn to react to a crisis with the attitude that it is an opportunity, so that the arrival of pressure is not itself a second problem. He also makes the point that a crisis is only overwhelming to the degree that it is unfamiliar, which is an argument for deliberately putting yourself in the way of manageable difficulty rather than avoiding all of it. Holtz argues that people who consistently perform well are not primarily doing something different with their technique. They are carrying a different feeling into the attempt, and the feeling arrives before the performance rather than after it. He calls it the winning feeling, and his claim is that it is a memory rather than a mood. You have succeeded at something at some point. That feeling is stored, and it can be deliberately recalled and brought to a situation that has nothing to do with the original success. The feeling is transferable even though the circumstances are not. So the instruction is to stock the theater of the mind with your own past successes and to rehearse them until the accompanying feeling is available on demand. He argues that most people do the exact opposite, keeping a detailed and well-maintained archive of their failures and only a vague impression of anything that went well, and that this is a choice about filing rather than an accurate record of a life. The practical version is to recall a success in sensory detail before you attempt something difficult, and to enter the attempt already carrying the feeling of a person who has done well before, because the mechanism will steer toward the picture it is given. The final chapter is Maltz's argument about vitality, and it is more interesting than the usual closing note of optimism. His position is that people do not decline primarily because of the passage of time. They decline because they run out of things they are steering toward. The goal-striving mechanism was built to strive, give it nothing to aim at, and it does not idle contentedly, it deteriorates, and the person deteriorates with it. Retirement, in his account, is dangerous not because of rest, but because of aimlessness. From this, he draws the conclusion that a person needs goals for the whole of their life, not merely for the productive middle of it, and that the goals must be genuinely wanted rather than assigned. He points to people who remained productive and alert into great age and observes that in almost every case, they were still working towards something specific. He is also making a quieter point about what the book has been arguing all along. The self-image does not stop operating at 60. A person who has concluded that they are now old and finished will act on that belief with the same fidelity that the young man acted on his belief that he could not speak in public. The belief is doing the work, as it always was. Stripped to its instructions, the book asks for a specific daily discipline, and the discipline is the point. Set aside about 30 minutes a day in a quiet place where you will not be interrupted. Relax the body first, deliberately, working through it. Go to your quiet room if you have built one. Then run the theater of the mind. Construct a scene in full sensory detail in which you are already the person you intend to be, handling the specific situation that matters to you and feeling as you would feel. Do not watch it from outside as a wish. Be in it. Do this whether or not you feel like it, and do not judge the session by how convincing it felt at the time. Maltz asks for at least 21 days before you assess anything, and this is the origin of the 21-day rule that has since escaped into general circulation. What he actually observed was that his surgical patients typically needed around 3 weeks to stop seeing their old face in the mirror, and that phantom limb sensations often faded on a similar timescale. He offered it as a minimum period before a mental image begins to shift in his clinical experience. He did not claim it as a law of habit formation, and the popular version of the idea is a good deal more confident than the man who coined it. Alongside the daily session, he asks for three ongoing habits. Feed the mechanism your successes rather than your failures. Read your negative feelings as steering information rather than as verdicts. And when you want to change a behavior, go after the picture rather than gritting your teeth, because imagination beats willpower every time the two are put in a fair fight. This book is more than 60 years old, and it should be read with that in mind. So here is the honest assessment. The evidence base is anecdotal. Maltz was an acute observer of his own patients, but what he offers is clinical impression and case history, not controlled research. When he cites experiments, he cites them loosely, and some of the studies that have been attached to this book over the years, including the most famous basketball one, have been retold with far more precision than the original support. The cybernetics framing is a metaphor doing duty as a mechanism. Comparing the nervous system to a servo mechanism was a vivid and useful analogy in 1960. It is not a model of how the brain works, and the book sometimes reasons from the metaphor as though it were established fact. The claim that the nervous system cannot tell the difference between a real and a vividly imagined experience is an overstatement. What is genuinely well supported is narrower and still valuable. Mental rehearsal does measurably improve motor skill performance. Motor imagery activates overlapping neural territory with execution, and the effect is real. But imagination and perception are not interchangeable, and the strong version of the claim does not hold. The 21-day figure has become one of the most repeated pieces of misinformation in self-help. The best available research on habit automaticity found a median closer to 66 days with enormous individual variation. Maltz's original observation was about a different thing entirely and was offered more modestly than it is now quoted. And there is a limitation of emphasis that matters. A book built on the premise that your results follow from your self-image can slide toward implying that people are simply responsible for their circumstances. Maltz himself is not crude about this, but the genre he founded frequently is, and the framework has little to say about material constraint, illness, or plain bad luck. What survives all of that is substantial. The central insight that behavior is regulated by an unexamined self-concept, that the self-concept was learned and can be revised, that mental rehearsal is a genuine skill and not a fantasy, and that negative emotion is better read as feedback than as judgment, are all defensible, useful, and were unusually well stated for their time. The most valuable thing in psycho-cybernetics is not any single technique, it is the reframe underneath all of them. Maltz asks you to consider that you are not being held back by a lack of capability or discipline or luck, but by a picture of yourself that you assembled a long time ago out of incomplete evidence and have never once thought to question, because it does not feel like a picture. It feels like the truth. Whether or not the machinery works exactly as he described it in 1960, that question has kept its force, and it is not a comfortable one to sit with. That was the summary of Psycho-Cybernetics by Maxwell Maltz. This narration is an original summary and commentary. It is not a substitute for the book, and it is not psychological or medical advice. If the ideas were useful to you, the full text is worth owning. From the AIIO Book Library, thank you for listening.